news, science, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia and a bunker below ground where the coffee is always strong, I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report, and we are launching into another week of exploration of the mysteries of our existence, and of course, in pursuit of the modern Grail quest, as we do every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com, our little hub, our corner on the web. Glad, as always, to be locking in with you guys for another week of attempts at understanding aspects of reality that are less often discussed, let alone understood. And tonight we have a lot on the table, including a check-in with a true living legend who is offering some insight about some newly released files by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. More on that a little later. And, of course, also reports on earthquake swarms that have been striking the North American continent in various locations. Some people are concerned. What's really going on? We'll take a look at that. Also, a check-in on the enduring mystery of MH370 before, in the second hour, getting into UFO discussion with regard to recent comments made by our commander-in-chief. Has he been briefed on the UFO subject? We'll look at that and a whole lot more. So glad, as always, to be able to be in the pocket with you guys and discussing these sorts of things. Hope everyone is well out there. Hope everybody had a great Father's Day weekend. I know I did. It was a gathering of the Satyrs, my dad's old rock and roll buddies from the 1960s, and Graylian X subscribers already know a little about this because they were made privy to a few stories that the band got together and told. And these aren't just old war stories about their years playing together in a band. Some of the stories that they were actually sharing had to do with everything from this crazy story I used to hear as a kid about this haunted house out there near the Asheville Regional Airport. And if you are a native Ashevillian, if you live anywhere near me, I'll go ahead and tell you that house is no longer there. When I was a kid, you know, when I was young and reckless, I would go out there looking for the thing myself. And it had already been torn down by that time. But lo and behold, this story comes up in conversation about this. I mean, it was a fabulous sounding place. It was three stories, like an old Victorian mansion, you know, almost like the archetypal haunted house. And sure enough, the guys, some of them had actually been there and visited it, and one of them shared a really hilarious story, which again, Graylian X subscribers may have already had time to catch up on and hear. But as we get into the summer months, and of course, following last week's episode, I've gotten a lot of feedback from you guys about our discussion about the 50-year anniversary of the Dennis Lloyd Martin disappearance. And again, special thanks to my pal Mike Bouchard for jumping on and talking with us about that. He and I have been in touch some since the interview as well. In fact, he was interviewed, I believe, by MSNBC about the case. And he had told them about this episode of the podcast that we had done and reported on that. But again, I'm kind of swept up in that story and a lot of similar disappearances that have occurred in national parks and other places. And one thing that I certainly know after visiting the Cades Cove Wilderness with Jason Pentrail is that if you're going to go in the woods, a few items you definitely want to carry with you. And this actually goes for anybody. If you're into hiking and camping like I am and you like getting out in the outdoors, a few things that you should definitely keep in mind. Carry extra water. But also, if you're in a really remote wilderness area and there are a lot of animals around, it's not a bad idea to carry pepper spray, too, because this can be very effective in warding off animals like black bears, which normally won't bother you, but sometimes are known, at least, to be aggressive toward humans, especially if it's a mother and her cubs are nearby. So that pepper spray might be helpful also. And then, if you're really spending a lot of time in the woods, a good idea is to carry a really good quality knife. And of course, most sporting goods stores, if you go in there, you'll see not only that they have a selection of good outdoor knives, but they've also got things like hatchets and, yes, machetes. And this is what caught the eye of one young man here in North Carolina, Braden Smith. He apparently had been given a $30 gift card to Academy Sports and Outdoors, and he was over there looking at the knives section and saw this machete and thought, hey, Dad, you know what? I can use that machete to bushwhack and clear brush when we go camping. And of course, under parental supervision, his dad didn't think this was a bad idea, although the $30 gift card wouldn't be enough to get this particular machete. It was about $45. So dad threw in an extra $15, and they got this machete for young Braden. And he said, my dad and I, we go camping a fair amount. But it wasn't in the outdoors that he would first end up using this machete, because according to the Raleigh News and Observer, The young man hadn't actually taken the tool camping yet, but he did use it to defend himself against a home invasion when a person recently tried to break into his house and steal his PlayStation. Now, the Observer reports that around 11 a.m. on Friday, Braden was playing Grand Theft Auto on his PlayStation when he heard someone outside of his North Carolina home. He ran to his bedroom in the 900-foot square home and looked out the window and said that there was a woman knocking on the door and two men were standing near a champagne-colored car. Well, Braden was on the phone with his mom. He asked her to call the police before he put the phone down in the living room and stepped behind the door in his bedroom. Through his window, he saw one of the men walk toward the other side of the home and heard a window get slammed in. He said, "My heart was beating, but I knew I had to do something, like hit him with something, so I grabbed the nearest weapon," and that, of course, ended up being the machete that they'd purchased. Now, at that point, he said a young man actually entered the home, who police have now identified. He grabbed a pellet rifle, which Braden said he knew was not loaded, and that when he came walking down the hall, he peeks in the door at Braden, and he apparently grabbed the machete from him, said, "Sit on the ground and get in the closet." Well, young 11-year-old Braden obeyed at that point until the man turned his back as he walked into the living room and started to pocket Braden's cell phone. Well, Braden picked up the machete that the man had dropped on the floor and then swung it at him and struck him in the back of the neck. So the man kicked Braden a few times and pushed him down. Braden swung the machete again. This time he missed. The man tried to grab the PlayStation and the television and leave with them. He said he noticed he was bleeding in the back of the head really badly, so he just dropped everything and ran out the door. "I hit him in the back with the machete," the boy told the 911 operator. Now, apparently that 911 call was made available afterward, and he describes on the telephone with the 911 operator fending off this intruder with his machete. So I guess it's not every day that an 11-year-old manages to stop a home invasion with a machete that his father helped him buy at the local sporting goods store. But one more reason why I've always said that even when you're going out in the forest, the animal that scares me most is the one that walks on two legs. Although there have been suppositions, of course, over the years about another kind of animal that might walk on two legs in North America, in parts of North America, at very least. We'll have an update about that a little later. But first, looking at some other news, there was an interesting story that the Sacramento Bee carried recently. Do you remember reading Dr. Seuss, either as a child yourself or maybe to your kids? And there was that story of the Lorax. And I always loved it as a child. I think it was really my favorite Dr. Seuss book, and it had a really strong environmental message. I guess you can tell I really like the outdoors, and that's because my parents raised me with a respect and appreciation for the wilderness. But the Sacramento Bee recently reported that the seaside cypress tree that is believed to have actually inspired the truffula trees that appear in that 1971 children's tale, The Lorax, has now finally toppled in Southern California. Now, what the tree actually was, and it did have a bushy appearance that was similar to the trees that are featured in that story, but this was a Monterey cypress. They said it stood 80 to 100 years in Ellen Browning Scripps Park in San Diego's La Jolla community before it finally fell on Thursday, according to officials. It was an iconic tree, a beloved tree, they said. Now, La Jolla was home to Dr. Seuss. Author and illustrator Theodore Seuss Geisel was his actual name. Now, for more than 40 years, from 1948 until his death in 1991, in Geisel's hands, the cypress with its long, sinewy trunk and densely clumped canopy became the cotton-candy-hued truffula. The tree's existence, threatened by logging, finds a protector in the Lorax, whose "I am the Lorax, I speak for the trees" became an environmentalist pop culture battle cry. Well, news of the tree that inspired the story spread over the weekend. I'm looking at a photograph of it right now, and again, it did look very much like the trees in that story. It was the last surviving Monterey cypress tree at Ellen Browning Scripps Park. But there is a bit of a mystery with this, because not only was it a famous tree and the last of its kind in that area, but officials also aren't entirely sure why the tree fell or what caused it to fall. Now, Timothy Graham, a spokesperson for the community there, says that the tree was alive and appeared to be in good health, save for termites. San Diego's weather, they say, was seasonably mild last week. Graham said on Monday that much of the tree has since been removed and that the city is, quote, looking to salvage it somehow. But the quote he gave to the Sacramento Bee was, "We're trying to figure out why the tree fell over. So what in the world had happened?" In any case, it was certainly an icon there in the area. But also in news coming out of California, in the last few days, there have been a lot of reports of a swarm of earthquakes. And in fact, KTLA 5 reported on this. They said that this swarm of earthquakes has taken the dimensions of a marathon in the area of the Southern California city of Fontana. And according to a Caltech seismologist, Egil Hawkson, they said that the chance that the series of tremors will turn into a large and destructive quake isn't particularly high, but that residents should still be on their guard. And it's kind of funny because they say it's not a particularly high chance. Nonetheless, though, they say the likelihood of a larger seismic event following these tremors, given so many quakes over such an extended period, is nonetheless higher than normal. And so Hawkson certainly advised that people should be concerned. This is probably the most prolific swarm, they say, that that area of the Fontana seismic zone has seen in the past 3 decades. A lot of reports of earthquakes in the news, in fact, because we move now over to Ohio, where there was also a report near Lake Erie of an earthquake that struck that area. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, a 1.5 magnitude quake happened near Willowick, Ohio, around 10:30 p.m. on Sunday night. CBS station WOIO reports that no damage had been reported with this. But there was another earthquake just about a week earlier. Some of you guys in the Cleveland area may have actually felt that. In fact, it was about a 4.0 magnitude quake that hit near Cleveland, and it was centered just off the city and once again centered there in Lake Erie. So a lot of earthquakes recently. That reminds me, by the way, there was footage that appeared online recently also that was claiming that animals are fleeing Yellowstone Park. Now, you probably already know why that may be significant, because if you followed this story like I have for quite some time, yeah, there is the expectation eventually that the sleeping supervolcano under Yellowstone Park will erupt. And so a lot of people were concerned when there was news being posted online about animals leaving Yellowstone in record numbers, like they're escaping what is yet to come. And the rumors have been spreading to such a prolific extent that even Snopes got involved. And they say that actually this is not true, but that there's some interesting origins behind this story. They say it goes back to March 30th, 2014, in fact, when Wyoming's Yellowstone Park was also struck by an earthquake. This one had been 4.8 magnitude at that time, and that was the most powerful earthquake that had hit the area since 1980. Well, in conjunction with that earthquake, and again more recently in April 2015, after reports of the discovery of a giant magma reservoir under Yellowstone hit the news, and I think that we did a lengthy segment on this program about that, videos then were posted online that were showing animals like buffalo seemingly running from their lives to leave the park. And that, of course, has continued until recently. Some of these same videos still in circulation. The fact is, however, that Snopes reports, there's no real evidence animals are actually fleeing Yellowstone Park or any particular area of it. They say paved roads, such as the one shown in many of the videos, make good migration routes for large animals such as bison in search of food or breeding grounds or the like, and that animals, especially large ones like in these videos that show them fleeing along these roadways, well, they aren't actually fleeing, they're just using this as a migratory path. And they say that this will happen whether or not there are earthquakes happening in that area. However, the tendency is that people don't pay attention to those kind of animal movements. If someone films something like that, there is an immediate tendency to say, well, that's unusual animal behavior, whether or not they know it is or it actually is. And therefore, what caused it? Why are those animals behaving that way? What's really going on? Is it a sign of the end times or, at very least, the imminent eruption of the Yellowstone supervolcano? Well, no, that's probably not the case. And Snopes says that what these videos don't document, which would be much more indicative of animals predicting an upcoming natural disaster, would be multiple different species all heading in the same direction, trying to get out of the park. But in almost every one of these videos, it's typically one species all moving, typically herding animals, moving together. And yes, indeed, this is actually pretty common behavior for these kind of animals. So at very least for the time being, there isn't any imminent threat of a Yellowstone super eruption occurring. Of course, in the eventual sense, like I've already pointed out, it is going to happen, but I just don't think these videos that we're seeing online right now that have been circulating yet again and have already been doing that for several years are indeed signs of the times. I'll tell you one place you certainly won't be seeing signs of the times is the island of Sommeroy off the northern coast of Norway. And the reason for this is because they are proposing that they become the first time-free zone in the world. According to CNN Travel, they said with the Northern Hemisphere's summer solstice just around the corner here on June 21st, Sommeroy, which literally means summer island, wants to get rid of its watches and maybe change them out for flower garlands because they want to become, as I mentioned, the first time-free zone in the world. Now, on this island in West Tromsø, north of the Arctic Circle, they say that the sun doesn't set from May 18th all the way up to July 26th. In other words, a full 69 days when the sun just doesn't set. Now, according to CNN Travel, the locals, having endured the long polar night from November to January when the sun doesn't rise at all, make the most of these precious months with no regard to conventional timekeeping. There's constantly daylight, one islander said, and so we act accordingly. In the middle of the night, like at around 2 a.m., you'll see kids outside playing soccer and people painting their houses or mowing their lawns and teens going for a swim. So they said, let's just get rid of time altogether. After all, time as we know it is sort of a construct, right? It's an idea. It's a concept that humans use. Now, I remember the famous debate between Henri Bergson and Einstein, where Einstein had said the time of the philosophers is dead. Now, the reason that Einstein said that is because, again, what we perceive as time in relation to gravity, materiality, the universe, you know, it is not this constant that we think it is. And as he predicted with general relativity, things like time dilation have later been proven. And we know that, again, if you want to get a good example of this, by the way, watch the film Interstellar. The implications of time dilation and the pliability of time in the physical sense of things is very well outlined and articulated in that film. But the philosophers over the centuries have dealt with time a little differently. And at the time that Einstein was proposing this revolutionary new theory of relativity, there were those in the philosophical community who were still kind of at odds with that idea. And some are still today. Because again, you can say that absolutely when we're talking about time in terms of physics, that yeah, time is something that exists and we understand what time is in relation to space and the cosmos. And of course, the old line from Doc Brown in Back to the Future comes to mind. Marty, you're not thinking fourth dimensionally, you know, thinking in terms of time. But as far as the passage of time and human perception of it, and the way that we relate to our environment based on that, yeah, I think that you could also make the argument that time is essentially just a construct. Time is a concept, but it's not really real. Because I say it's 1 p.m. here, where I am, and you may say that it is 4 p.m. in a time zone where you are. So whose time is correct? Well, of course, it doesn't really matter. Because the truth is, we're both just in different positions on the same Earth globe relative to our distance from the sun and the direction, of course, that the sun is hitting it. And as the Earth spins, the amount of light that hits various parts of the globe changes over the course of what we call a day. And therefore, in certain time zones, it may be recognized as a different time relative to Earth and its orientation with the sun. But at the end of the day, we're all on the same Earth. There's only one of them. There's only one sun. And we just measure these differences as a form of timekeeping, which allows us to kind of relate to our environment and the passing of time, as we know it, a little better. I've often said this in the past, and in fact, I had a wonderful conversation with my pals Scott and Forrest with Astonishing Legends recently, and we were talking about this favorite chapter of mine in Sir Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time, and that is The Arrow of Time. And on a forthcoming episode of that podcast, we're going to go really deep in terms of trying to understand the relationship between time in the sense of physics, the thermodynamic constraints on it, and also the way that that affects human perception, and especially things like memory. Because as Sir Stephen Hawking said, there are actually three arrows of time. And those involve the relationship between what we perceive as time and thermodynamics. And all that essentially states is that time moves in the same direction in which entropy increases. Simple example, you know, a glass sitting on a table, when it falls off the table and breaks, you're never going to see that glass reassemble itself and jump back up onto the table. Things in nature, in other words, tend to move toward states of disorder or chaos. And this is, again, the effect of entropy. And you never see it going the other way. And so thermodynamically speaking, we recognize that as being a one-way ticket. Time moves in one direction, and more specifically with regard to the second law of thermodynamics. Although there are some little paradoxes there, but I'll save that for another conversation because fascinating though they are, they'll just get us off topic here. The second recognized arrow of time has to do with human perception. And you might say that all of these do, because again, if we're talking about them, this all is somewhat beholden to human perception of what we perceive as physical laws in the universe. Nonetheless, I think that there are measurable ways that we can define these things as constants. So in addition to the thermodynamic law, there is the human perception of time. Simple example of this one. We remember the past. And Hawking had said that if it weren't for the fact that entropy has an effect on the function of our mind and perception, we might be able to remember the future also. But he said that essentially it seems that human perception and brain function is beholden to the exact same sort of entropic forces that we see when the egg breaks. And then Humpty Dumpty, as the old nursery rhyme goes, can't be put back together again, right? That's a wonderful nursery rhyme because it is a statement on the arrow of time and entropic forces in the universe. And so Hawking said that just like the egg can't reassemble, the glass can't unbreak itself, our memory pertains to the past, and those same entropic forces seem to place limitations on human mind and its function too, which to me is really interesting because in his book, and I told Scott and Forrest this when we had our conversation, I'd mentioned the fact that in A Brief History of Time, Hawking says, we can't really talk about entropy and its effect on the mind and memory and history and what we understand as the past in the most complete way because we simply don't understand all the functions of the human mind yet. He said, we have a really good understanding of how computers work, however, and therefore we will use a computer as an example for what I feel are the same kinds of entropic forces that are working on the human brain. But that was really interesting because although I know exactly what he was saying, to me that seems to have sort of left the door open. We don't know all the functions of the brain, so it's a little hard for us to talk about how entropy affects that and human perception of time. But due to the fact that we don't know all the ins and outs of human perception of time, I wonder about things like people who claim to have had premonitions. And this is part of what we get into with Scott and Forrest. The idea that people might have premonitions of future events, and more specifically, more often than not when this occurs in the literature, sparing though it is, credulous even though some of those claims may be, it's interesting because often people don't describe having some sort of an, you know, kind of omniscient third-person perspective on future events that happen, where they see a plane falling out of the sky or something. Now, when they have a premonition, often people will describe the premonition involving how they read or perhaps they dream about an experience where they're reading a newspaper or something or seeing on television and learning about the experience themselves in a future circumstance that, again, has not yet happened. And in that sense, I wonder sometimes if what people sometimes claim to experience as psychic premonitions or something like that, if entropically speaking, they aren't really more akin to memories of the future, and that perhaps there are aspects of thermodynamics that would allow for such a thing to occur under the right circumstances. I don't know, I'm speculating. And again, although Hawking never said that in his book, by very virtue of the fact that he says, let's talk about computers rather than the human mind because our understanding of the way the mind works is incomplete, seems to sort of leave the door open for that possibility. So I found that kind of fascinating. And then finally, the third and final thermodynamic arrow that he talks about is the cosmological arrow of time. As the universe, ever since the Big Bang, has been in an outward state of expansion, again, there is a direction of time. The flow of time cosmologically also is an arrow of time in that sense. So that's my favorite chapter in that book because of all of the implications about human thought, memory, perception, and all these kind of things. And I think they do raise some of the old questions philosophers once had about whether or not time as we know it actually exists. In the physical sense, sure it does, of course, but perhaps our picture of that nonetheless is still thermodynamically incomplete. But then again, if you live in a part of the world where it is daylight all day for portions of the year, yeah, what does time mean to you? It's kind of relative, isn't it? All right, more when we return. I am Micah Hanks. It is The Graylian Report. We will be right back. Welcome back. It is The Graylian Report. Glad, as always, to be able to be keeping you company. Now, you know, here in the Deep South, from time to time, we hear peculiar stories, legends, if you will. In fact, I heard one of them over the weekend from my good old pal, Bruce, who had been the drummer in my dad's band. He always told this story when I was a child of seeing something unusual up on a hill over in neighboring Madison County. Now, if you've ever been to North Carolina, of course, Madison County is probably one of the more remote areas in this region. And it was there back in the 1950s that Bruce, as a young boy, my father's drummer, he was about 12 years old, and he saw something very large, walking upright, dark-colored, attempting to get into the chicken house behind his house one evening. And I asked him, you know, was this a bear? Was it a person? Was it a Bigfoot? He said, look, you know, I'm not sure. He said, whatever it was, it walked off on two legs. But he said, I thought at first it would have been a bear because it appeared to be hairy. You do hear those kind of stories from time to time. And a little further south of here, there is quite a tradition pertaining to the so-called skunk ape, as it's known. And CBS Miami reported on this recently. They said, as you head west on US 41 toward Big Cypress National Preserve, you'll pass Clyde Butcher's Art Gallery in the United States' smallest post office. And then you'll also reach the official skunk ape research headquarters in Okeechobee on Ta Miami Trail near Naples. Now, every few years, these fellows who run that kind of a roadside attraction, the Skunk Ape Headquarters, I see news stories kind of giving an update on what they're up to. And I actually support these kinds of little, again, you might call them roadside attractions. There is the Expedition Bigfoot down in Georgia, not very far from where I am, where they actually have quite a remarkable museum with all kinds of artifacts, relics, you know, footprint castings, photographs, and things like that. And theirs is reportedly one of the largest in the United States. I haven't made it down there yet. I'd like to. I'd like to go see this Skunk Ape Research Center as well, whether or not you believe those creatures exist. And in fact, there are many serious researchers into the study of Sasquatch who perceive that if this creature existed, it is only conceivable that it would exist in the Pacific Northwest. There's no way in the minds of many of the old guard researchers that these things could exist in the Southeast as populated as regions of Florida and similar locales actually are. Nonetheless, there is actually quite a vivid history of alleged sightings, especially in Florida. Florida is one of the, I think, like the top three states where sightings of alleged ape-like creatures occur. And so even if you only look at this as being a cultural phenomena and you don't believe that those animals exist, I still think it's really fascinating. I love the idea of these little roadside exhibits that introduce you to some of the folklore and the culture of these areas. That's interesting to me, regardless of whether or not there is a physical creature behind these claims. And yet, I'm one of these people who, you know, although I'm on the fence at times, and it's not because I just can't make up my mind, there is a bit of a issue, I guess, logically, that arises with the problem of understanding how a creature like this, let alone a breeding population of them, could remain hidden for so long, and yet there could also be so many sightings. Can every person who claims that they are seeing something that resembles an upright walking ape, generally larger than humans, I mean, can every person who has made the claim of having seen something like that in the last several hundreds of years, in fact, because in addition to there being already several hundreds of years of accounts recorded by trappers, missionaries, prospectors, historians, anthropologists, outdoorsmen, all kinds of people who have helped chronicle a body of information about this subject. And then you go even further back to the First Nations traditions about the existence of these things. And I've seen people try to say that, oh, you know, that's cultural appropriation, to try and project the modern idea of Sasquatch onto the cultural belief systems of Native Americans. I actually think that quite the contrary. If you look at what they say and the descriptions that they give of wild people in their various mythologies, no, they aren't always exactly the same. And there is some room for consideration about the difference between cultural mythologies and what some perceive as being the physical existence of a creature, even in modern times. But I nonetheless maintain that it's actually doing a disservice if you look at the specificity of the accounts in certain Native American traditions, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, and you try to take away from that and say, well, no, what you're describing isn't really what you're describing. Again, this is just a mythology. Throughout the years, there have often been perspectives offered by First Nations representatives who say, look, you know, you guys come in here and try and tell us what our beliefs mean to us and what they actually entail. If you would just listen, you would hear what we're trying to tell you. These things exist. They have been here. At one time, we even began to think that they were extinct because we never saw them. But of course, with the proliferation of railroads, the expansion westward, the search for material resources, and then, of course, the founding of cities and communities, and therefore population increase that results from all this, yeah, with more people living in that region, all of a sudden you do start seeing around the turn of the last century a rise in reports. And around the 1920s, there was actually a bit of a buzz in a lot of the Northwestern newspapers about all the sightings and interactions people in that region were claiming to have. Yeah, when there are more people in a region where something like this is allegedly going on, yeah, people start encountering those things. And again, I would compare that to people saying, I'd never seen a bear in my life. And then I retired and I moved to Asheville, North Carolina, and I could not believe it. One morning, there's a bear in my backyard. And I'm like, well, yeah, first of all, these animals were here first. And when there was more wilderness in this area, they were able to hide a lot better. But as urban sprawl continues, now everybody complains about the bears camping out in their backyard and the white-tailed deer dining in their flower pots in the mornings. You know, the coyotes and the raccoons picking the scraps out of the garbage heap. Things like this. Yeah, I mean, these things were here first, but it takes people moving to an area often to be in proximity to where they will actually see these things. And so one might argue that the rise to prominence of the Pacific Northwestern Sasquatch as a cultural phenomenon really kind of beginning around the turn of the last century and into the first couple of decades there, and then really coming to a head in the 1950s. Yeah, one could really interpret that, if there is indeed an animal involved here, as more people inhabiting an area and having interactions with an animal that was there first and which is extremely wary of human presence. So all that to say, if you look back at the literature, if you look at the consistency in the narratives, those that are shared by modern experiencers and also the cultural traditions of the First Nations people, you know, there is an impressive body of evidence. And so I guess that sort of the psychic disunion that arises from that is, how do you account for this incredible body of information, this cultural tradition, people who claim that they still see the things even today? And yet, apart from some footprint castings, the majority of which I would actually deem very unreliable as evidence, and I have reasons for that, which I won't get into right now, but apart from that, there is very little, if any, physical evidence that supports the existence of these creatures. So when you have an alleged creature that science simply can't prove because there's absolutely no physical evidence in support of it, and yet there is a plethora of anecdotal witness reporting on this and a cultural tradition going back centuries, yeah, it is a weird kind of a phenomenon. That's maybe the weirdest thing about Bigfoot. It is either one of the most complex cultural phenomena that has ever come to pass in terms of modern human civilization, or there is an actual physical creature behind those reports. It is one or the other. It could be a sort of a complex combination of the two, but if that's the case, that would still seem to entail that there's a creature, right? And so I'll just leave it at, there is either an animal or there is not. But if there is not, there is something nonetheless worthy of study. And so I actually enjoy the idea of this becoming sort of an aspect of people's culture and this being represented in museums and roadside attractions, art, music, you know, things like this. Sasquatch, you might say, has sort of become the great totem of North America. It is like our national animal, and we're not even sure if it exists. But you see him on bumper plates, you see him as air fresheners dangling from people's rearview mirrors, all kinds of stuff. And so I haven't gotten down there to the Everglades to visit the Skunk Ape Research Facility, but I'd like to get down there. I think it'd be really great to get down there and actually see what they have. And it's owned by Jack and Dave Sheely. Those are the two brothers that own this facility. They say a lot of folks come in here and the first thing they ask is, what is a skunk ape? The skunk ape is the southernmost relative, he says, of Bigfoot, like a Yeti or a Sasquatch. All of the stories over the years add up to sightings of some sort of large mammal in the Glades. Now, he insists that there are 7 to 9 skunk apes currently living in the Everglades. You know, that's a funny statement because I often hear it asked, how do you know that there are 7 to 9 of them existing? That's not even barely enough for a breeding population. I mean, that would be absolute critical endangerment, right? If there are only 7 to 9 of these things. Apparently, Dave says, there have been skunk apes spotted on the Loop Road, which is in the Big Cypress Preserve. Some of the most well-covered sightings were in Davie, Florida, which Davie has grown up now, but back in the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of skunk ape sightings in the Davie area. The legend of the skunk ape here in the Florida Everglades goes back hundreds of years, he says, all the way back to the indigenous cultures, and my father has spent the better part of 20 years trying to find out if there's any truth to that. Dave Sheely, according to CBS Local, claims to have seen one of the hairy man-like beasts as a child, and again 3 more times, including in 2000 when he shot video of the creature in an open field. He said, I was actually looking for deer that day. I wanted to get some photographs for some hunting friends of mine. That's when I heard something moving in the water. It was running. It wasn't running like a deer or a bear. Now, again, I guess you got to kind of ask, how likely is it that a creature like that could exist in the Florida Everglades? And in fact, that's exactly what they quote one woman, a visitor named Becky Cunningham, saying. In the Everglades, anything is possible. She says, it's hard to say what we're going to have roaming around out there because nobody gets to see all of the Everglades. Now, again, if you're thinking about areas where a creature like that could conceivably remain hidden, if there's any place in the southeast that that's going to happen, I would say it would be in swampy areas, and the Everglades would be probably one of the best locations. And there are a few reasons why. It is a warm, essentially tropical climate. It's warm there all year round. I mean, I've been down there in Florida and down along the coasts. It's not uncommon for it to be in the 70s and 80s, even in January. Of course, there is the habitat. Again, the Everglades would provide a lot of food. The Everglades would provide a lot of cover. Again, it's not inconceivable that an animal could remain hidden there. And something else that I've found really interesting for a long time, as I've reported plenty on the show here in the last few months, the idea that the eastern cougar, which is, as of 2018, recognized as being extinct. Well, you know, there are still cougars, the Florida panther, which exist in the Everglades. There's a small number of them. And some have actually raised the idea about Bigfoot that when you look at old newspaper articles, there are reports of encounters with wild men that seem to resemble what we would recognize culturally today as Sasquatch that occurred more prevalently in the eastern parts of the United States many, many decades ago or centuries ago. Early newspaper accounts, in other words, from the middle 1800s and early 1900s, still offered reports that we would call very similar to what we call Sasquatch today. But then those tend to start going away over the ensuing decades. And now, if you hear about these things, generally the most frequent locations that you hear about anything like that is the Pacific Northwest and, yeah, the Everglades, which is interesting because further west we still have the Western Cougar and we have the Florida Panther. The Eastern Cougar, on the other hand, is one of the more recent casualties of urban sprawl. And yes, this animal, although some claim that these might still exist in very small pockets, they are recognized as being extinct. There could be a corollary there. Again, that there are animals perhaps that are driven away from certain areas or actually driven to extinction by human populations. And so it's interesting that in a location like the Everglades where people say they still see a creature resembling a human, but much more ape-like, that you also still have panthers because that's essentially the same thing in the Northwest. You still have the Western cougars in a much more remote and rugged environment with high elevations and a lot of wilderness that human eyes have never seen even to this day. And I think a lot of people tend to take that for granted, just how remote those regions actually are. Now, Bigfoot has been in the news a lot lately because of a really peculiar story, and I think I touched on this already. But of course, when the FBI at their reading room recently released files they had on Bigfoot, the press went nuts. What a lot of people didn't know about that, of course, as I had mentioned, was that my pal John Greenwald had been the very guy who had sent a Freedom of Information Act request for those documents. And the documents, after he requested them and then they were released, the FBI, a few months later, posted at their reading room on their website. And once they were posted online for all to see, they'd already been at John Greenwald's Black Vault website for a number of months, then the mainstream media jumps on board with the story, you might say. And one of the reasons that many of us were very interested in what the FBI files on Bigfoot had to say, there wasn't very much. It was essentially just this. A number of hair samples in the mid-1970s had been supplied to the FBI, and their forensic lab agreed to do a test and try and determine what these hair samples might have belonged to. And those hair samples were supplied to the FBI by none other than Peter Byrne, a one-time big game hunter and a man who had traveled the world. He'd lived in Nepal, he had traversed India, he had searched for the Yeti, and then he came to the United States in the early 1960s in search of the American Sasquatch. And recently I reached out to Peter Byrne, and he was kind enough to spend almost an hour talking with me. And at some point in the future, I want to feature that entire interview, but in a very special context, because I just want to say, that was on my bucket list, ladies and gents. The first book by Peter Byrne that I ever acquired was given to me by my father when I was 5 years old. And he is 94 years old. He still lives in the Pacific Northwest. He isn't actively involved. It's now a part-time endeavor, but he is still involved in research into this mystery. And some of the big takeaways from our conversation were that, you know, in almost 50 years of research, he says there is no reliable physical evidence that he says he's ever found. Nonetheless, he says there are still what he deems reliable witness sightings that occur, which compel him to think that there may still be something to this phenomena. But I caught up with Peter, and I want to feature a quick soundbite because I asked him about the FBI releasing these files and his own recollections at the age of 94 about supplying these samples to the FBI, what he hoped to learn at that time, and why he wants to get in touch with the FBI today and try and follow up on that case after all these years. We have that audio. The FBI only recently released their documents, which illustrated how in the 1970s you had supplied some hair samples to their forensic lab for study.
That's true.
Yeah.
There'd been a very good sighting, two-day sighting, Friday and a Thursday and a Friday, two men on one day, two men on the second day, and we were very lucky. We got it very quickly, because sometimes we get a sighting 10 years later. Got it very quickly, and Saturday morning went up to where they'd seen this thing, went up with the two men, and they showed me where it had been, and they showed me where it took off, and these huge gouge marks in the pine needles. And my brother was with me, and we looked for hair. And there's some thorn bushes nearby, and there's some hair snagged on the thorn. And so we gathered it. And then we came back and said, what the heck are we going to do with it? So I called the FBI just for fun. I said, would you do us a great favor and look at this? They said, yes. So we sent it to them. And didn't hear back from them for a very long time. And heard almost nothing, to where I think at the time they thought it was a bit of a joke. And then suddenly they find this 22 pages of documents, including letters from me after, was it 40 years? 40 years later, and they released those to a wire service. So it's gone all over the world in the last 10 days, and I've had a lot of calls, newspapers, television people, interviews and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So my hope is, I'm trying to get a contact in the FBI now, and I think I can get one, and see if they kept any of theirs. Because nowadays, we could DNA them, and that would be very important. They still may be deer hairs, which is what they thought the hairs they had, but might be something else.
Again, what a pleasure to talk with Peter Byrne. I mean, after all these years, still interested in this stuff, still trying to follow up on cases like this that go all the way back to the 1970s when he was actively involved in the field, you know, spending weeks on end out there in the forest with a team of professionals that he had hired. He had scientific funding from various different organizations at that time, and he was actively involved in pursuit of trying to get to the bottom of this. And at age 94, still working. And, you know, I've had a lifelong fascination with the subject, but I'm still very comfortable being agnostic about it. And although Peter expressed to me that he absolutely believes there is a valid and real phenomena, he acknowledges there's no physical evidence. Most of these people who are going out there and screaming in the mountains and calling to these things and banging on trees with baseball bats, that's all rubbish. He says, I'm telling you right now, most of what you see on television, most of what is claimed by the experts is absolutely unreliable and has no bearing on the reality of this subject. And most of all, and he said, take this to the bank, don't ever forget it, I am not an expert. He says, there are very few experts. Anyone who claims to be an expert, immediately distrust them and absolutely never call me an expert. He says, I'll give you my thoughts and my opinions. I'm not an expert on Sasquatch. Well, I might have to differ, but at very least, I appreciate Peter's attitude toward the subject. Don't just take things for granted. You've got to be critically minded and skeptical. And indeed, he is very much like that. At the age of 94, still on the hunt. All right, more when we return here on the Graylian Report.
Science, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
Welcome back. Oh my, how the time flies when you're having fun. We always have a great time on this program, enjoying conversations with, again, some true icons in the field like Peter Byrne. We will feature more from that conversation on a special occasion in the future. I have some good ideas and some plans in the works for some fun stuff along those lines. But of course, those longtime subscribers of Graylian X already enjoy the fun stuff on a weekly basis because there is, of course, the additional edition of the podcast, the Graylian X podcast, that we put out every single week. And there was a very special edition of that, a Father's Day episode that dropped only recently. And, of course, the monthly specials known as Graylian Enigmas. It's easy to sign up if you would like to get access to extra content. Just head over to Graylian Report, GRAYEN Report.com/X. And you can sign up there. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year. We are having more and more of you guys making your way down here into the dark heart of the hollow earth to join our endeavors. That's right. And later in this hour, I want to get a little into the side of maybe not politics, but certainly not even exopolitics. Just what politicians have had to say about the UFO subject. That has always interested me. In fact, years ago, I pitched a column idea to a magazine about presidential UFOs, people and perspectives related to politics and what has been said about UFOs. And yeah, there have been a number of U.S. presidents who have actually been at times surprisingly vocal about that subject. But before we shift gears and get into that, I kind of want to tie in something that's more in line with what we talked about in the last segment, on the heels of our clip of the discussion with Peter Byrne commenting on the FBI files released that detailed his own search for answers about hair samples that he had found back in the 1970s. There was a recent update about a missing person, a man who, in fact, had actually gone missing in the Cascades. And, of course, back in his heyday, when Peter Byrne was actively involved in Sasquatch research, that was kind of ground zero. Their home base, as it were, was around the region known as the Dalles up in Oregon, and they were actively involved in trying to find evidence of these creatures up there, impartially because of the rugged and remote region that the Cascade Mountains supplies. That's always been an area where there's been a lot of the tradition and the culture and the legends associated with these creatures. That's kind of been a hot spot for all of that. But at one point, Peter Byrne had brought up to me when we spoke Elkanah Walker's diary, which we've referenced several times in the past on the program, way back in 1840 when he had said that among the Spokane, there is belief in a race of giants on one of the high mountains off to the west. They are stealers of men. And you knew when they were coming because you would hear them whistling up in the woods. And I mentioned that to Peter and I said, you know, yeah, they refer to them as men stealers. And he kind of said, well, yeah. And he didn't seem to really touch on that subject quite so much. I do know in the past, of course, that Peter had wrote fairly extensively about the accounts given by men like Albert Ausman, a prospector who in the 1920s claimed that he was kidnapped by one of the creatures around Toba Inlet. And then there was also the story of a man named Mutualat Harry. He was actually one of the Mutualat Native Americans and had claimed that he also had been kidnapped and taken to a sort of a camp where all of these man-like creatures were gathered there in the mountains. Now, we didn't really talk about those historic cases. I feel if we had, he probably would have mentioned what he'd already written about decades ago, but he didn't really seem to have a whole lot to say about these implications and the legends and whatnot about these creatures being kidnappers of people, even though that remains a trope that is implied even with various literature pertaining to search and rescue these days. You know, I guess the kind of genre that was defined by David Politis, known as Missing 411, although David himself never comes out and explicitly says that these are kidnappings that are occurring. I think a lot of people have actually read into that over the years. And I actually had a friend once who asked him point blank during an interview, do you think it's Bigfoot kidnapping these people? And he kind of got angry and said, that's absolutely not what I'm saying. You know, I'm not inferring that in the least. This subject is completely unconnected to that. And, you know, for those who would say he takes a rather harsh tone with people about that, again, I think that he's a little concerned about that connection being made, especially considering that David Politis has had an interest in Sasquatch and had written books about that subject prior to getting involved in the Missing 411 stuff. Nonetheless, I think, though, that there is this connection that many people tend to make between some of the disappearances of individuals in our national parks and the cultural phenomena, for lack of a better term, that is the Sasquatch. Well, there was an update about a missing person who had actually disappeared in the Cascades, that very same area where Peter Byrne had worked for so many years. Gavin Johnston was his name, and the Everett Washington Herald reported about this. He has been found. Of course, he was deceased, but Johnston was missing since October. Reportedly, he was found just this past Monday, dead south of Stevens Pass. Now, they say that Gavin Johnston, who was 28 years old, told his father on October 17th he was headed to the Pacific Northwest and he wanted to hike the Pacific Crest Trail for a 2-month backpacking trip. Now, you hear a story like this. I mean, there are dozens of them. And people immediately begin to say, this is suspicious. What happened to this guy? Just goes backpacking, vanishes. Well, here's what his family had said when he went missing. They said he had virtually no backpacking experience. He had virtually no wilderness experience in general. And further, he may have also been in the middle of a mental health crisis. Now, Herald.net reporting on this case noted that the King County Sheriff's Office confirmed that a body was found early Monday afternoon in the Alpine Lakes Wilderness area. The medical examiner's office has not released an official identification, but according to the family, a hiker spotted Johnston near the trail by Glacier Lake in a sleeping bag with a rosary in his hand. He was found with a phone, a wallet, and gear that he reportedly bought before leaving. They say, "We know it was Gavin." Family and friends said Tuesday that Gavin Johnston was quiet, but he was kind. He had piercing blue eyes and his beard was shaved, a boyish face that made him look years younger than he actually was. He was a devout Catholic who attended daily mass several times a week at Our Lady of Perpetual Help Church in Everett. They say when he wasn't at church, he could often be seen at the Safeway on Broadway, where he spent much of his working life. More recently, he had a job at an aerospace parts manufacturer. In his spare time, he liked to play video games and classical guitar and spend time with his parents. But again, about his mental state prior to his disappearance, Marvin Johnston said his son was likely having a mental health crisis before he left for the mountains. Gavin had called his father one day in October saying he was going backpacking on the Pacific Crest Trail, which spans from Canada to Mexico along the west coast. He said he wanted to go into the forest to pray and become closer with God. He didn't have any hiking experience or wilderness survival experience, though, and it wouldn't have been long before the weather took a turn for the worse there in the mountains. His father said he still had a recording of the phone call and said that his son's voice sounded cheerful. So Gavin, again, this seems to have been very fueled by his religious beliefs. He sold all his belongings. He bought about $1,100 in gear from Cabela's, outdoor gear. And then what was left over, he made a donation to the Everett Gospel Mission's men's shelter, donated that money. Not long after that, they say the family reported their son is missing, put up flyers, and began searching. But again, he was found up there in the Cascades in his sleeping bag, rosary still in his hand. There doesn't seem to be any indication that he was a victim of any kind of a crime or that there was any kind of a third party involved. My guess would be since he was found with rosary in hand in the sleeping bag, he very well may have actually succumbed to the elements. If the weather turned for the worse, he very likely could have frozen to death there on the mountain. And that's the important aspect to all this. Sometimes the simplest explanation is the most likely. And when people go missing like this, and this person was saying and doing strange things before they go missing, there are these layers of mystery that are piled onto these cases, and people read an awful lot into them. You add to that the fact that this guy goes missing in what many have considered to be ground zero for Sasquatch sightings. And yeah, you have the unfortunate makings for a completely overblown mystery. As his parents had said, this young man probably had had mental health issues, a crisis of sorts, some of this even fueled by aspects of his faith and his belief system, and the fact that he had no experience hiking or camping and went into one of the most rugged and demanding territories in the western United States didn't help. It did not improve his chances of coming out on the other side of this experience any less worse for the wear. So, again, my heart goes out to the family, but when you see circumstances like this, and the ways that people will read into a story like this. I mean, just go look on Reddit and read the different threads where a disappearance like this occurs and the things that people say. Could it be that a flying humanoid swept down and grabbed him and carried him away? You will see things like this. People will make very unusual, illogical conclusions about these cases that have this air of mystery about them, you see. Yeah, sadly, I think that often it's far less mysterious. It's no less tragic. And so again, my heart goes out to those who have lost family members as a result of circumstances like this, and often they can be prevented. And that's why I drive that point home so often on this program. Remember, again, to carry with you items that can be used in the event of an emergency, items that might save your life. You know, a GPS locator is going to help. Sometimes they can ping your phone, but often if you don't have service or if your phone dies, it's going to be really hard to do that. Again, a GPS locating unit is going to be absolutely vital if you become injured and you're in an area where otherwise search and rescue may not be able to reach you or find you. Always carry water. Don't get off the beaten paths if you don't have experience being up there in the backcountry. This coming from a guy who actually fell off a mountain one time. It wasn't fun. It was my own brush with almost going missing 411 myself. I know the kinds of dangers that you can face in the remote and rugged wilderness. Don't take chances with your life. Always be prepared. Let somebody know where you're going, how long you're going to be, when you'll be back, and where people can find you while you're gone. And in the event that you don't turn up where you're supposed to be at the agreed designated time thereafter, people need to know where to go and start looking. This is the way that you save lives. You protect yourself, you plan ahead, let others know where you're going, and for God's sake, don't do stupid things when you're by yourself in the woods. And as simple as that equation is, those key elements right there may save your life. If you're hard-headed like me and you enjoy going out in the forest and facing some of the perils, again, the woods aren't particularly dangerous. There are dangerous things in the forest. But it's all about knowing where you're going, what you're doing, and how to prepare for your time in that environment. And if you're not experienced, consider, if you really want to get out in the woods, consider hiring a guide. That way you can actually be in the company of someone who is very experienced and will know exactly where to go, what to do, where to take you, and help ensure that you are safe wherever you may end up. So, anyway, end of public service announcement. I want to shift gears now and talk a little bit about this big story that broke over the weekend, because George Stephanopoulos did an interview with Donald Trump there at the White House. And during this interview, the question was brought up as to whether or not Donald Trump had feelings about the Navy changing their reporting policies pertaining to UFOs. That's right, a lot of us were very surprised to hear this come up in the conversation, and it was even more surprising the fact that Trump seemed to allude to the fact that at least on one occasion he had had some kind of a meeting about this subject. Before we read too much into that, here is the audio soundbite where he actually told Mr. Stephanopoulos his feelings about the UFO subject.
Before we go, one of the things you have as president is the access to all the information
right
in the world, all the mysteries out there. And I was just struck in the last couple of weeks, we're reading more and more reports of Navy pilots seeing lots and lots of UFOs. Have you been briefed on that? What do you make of it?
I have. I think it's probably, I want them to think whatever they think. They do say, I mean, I've seen and I've read and I've heard, and I did have one very brief meeting on it, but people are saying they're seeing UFOs. Do I believe it? Not particularly.
Do you think you'd know if there were evidence of extraterrestrials?
Well, I think our great pilots would know. And some of them really see things that are a little bit different than in the past. So we're going to see. But we'll watch it. You'll be the first to know.
So there you go. Our president, Donald Trump, has finally chimed in on UFOs. I do seem to recall that at one point during the last election, Bernie Sanders had also been asked about that, and he expressed similar sentiments. He didn't really have much of an opinion on that subject. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, had actually had quite an opinion on the subject, which we'll touch on a little more here in a moment. But this is the first time that we've actually heard the current commander-in-chief address this subject at all. And what does he say? Well, you know, again, our pilots and people say that they're seeing these things. I want them to believe whatever they believe. I don't really particularly believe it myself. And my good pal Red Pill Junkie wrote an excellent op-ed over there at the Daily Grail about this, commenting on his lack of interest in the subject, despite some of the recent developments that we've seen with pertinence to the Navy, and also, as Navy spokesman Chris Sherwood had said, the U.S. Air Force, that they both are intending to improve their reporting system with regard to this subject due to the fact that many of our servicemen and women have been having experiences that involve aircraft and objects they can't identify. So it is interesting that in addition to seeming to have some knowledge of that, again, Donald Trump refers to our great pilots. He seems quite aware of the fact that pilots are saying they're seeing things. But in terms of him saying, do I believe it? Not particularly. What I would take from that is that really what is being said is, I don't really have an interest in this subject. You know, it doesn't seem to be to me a matter of what do you believe when we're talking about UFOs. With people trying to kind of sterilize this subject, and you're seeing a shift away from UFO and more people saying actual unidentified flying objects, or they're sometimes saying UAP and various things like this. You know, when you're seeing a lot of these commentators talking about the subject, Leslie Kane, you know, who had co-authored the pieces that appeared in the New York Times, including the recent one that I tweeted about, which went viral, talking about the Navy and their ongoing sightings of these things. Most, if not all, of the commentators in the public forum on this subject in recent weeks have tended to try and say that, you know, we don't know what these things are. They could be a foreign technology. Whatever they are, if we can't identify them and they are in our airspace, we need to treat the subject seriously. And that is the general sentiment. So when Trump says, you know, I don't really particularly believe, I think that that is a general statement and in accordance with the existing stigmas pertaining to that subject, which very simply, and again to boil all this down, means UFO equals extraterrestrial. Again, I think that with regard to being asked about UFOs and him saying, I don't particularly believe, what I would infer is that he doesn't particularly believe that our pilots are encountering extraterrestrial vehicles and basically wanted to make a non-committal kind of statement about it. And I think because of that, that's probably why a lot of the media latched onto the fact that he said, I did have one brief meeting about it. Now, to my knowledge at the present time, we don't know who that meeting was with, what was actually discussed, you know, what the nature of that, or maybe what the sensitivity of the information that was discussed actually was. We simply don't know. He says, I had one brief meeting about it. But I do think that we could come to some logical conclusions about what that could mean. And I've boiled that down to a couple of different alternatives. One would be that he might have been briefed, an actual briefing occurred, by members of the military in some capacity where they wanted to update the commander-in-chief about the reality of what they perceive as a UFO phenomena that they are having interactions with and that they want to be reporting on this. And they basically just kind of give him an update and say, look, this is a thing and this is what we're doing. That might constitute the brief meeting he's talking about. The other alternative is that it could have also been a lobbyist or a lobbyist group that wanted to meet with him. It may have had no relationship to UFOs, but that subject might have come up in the broader context of a meeting. And that also might have applied to some kind of a military briefing that he might have received. In other words, the subject of UFOs might have briefly come up in the context of a broader discussion and with regard to a meeting that might not have been designated as a discussion about UFOs. The subject might have come up. In any case, those things might constitute the reasons for a brief meeting on that subject that would have occurred, and Trump just kind of mentions it in passing. He doesn't seem to indicate that there was anything of particular importance to national security, at least as he perceived it during that meeting. So it was only natural that the press jumped all over that, and rather than a brief meeting, as he mentioned, many in the news were describing Trump having been briefed on UFOs. That may not be the case. A meeting could constitute a number of different things. We don't know. There was very little information given, and Stephanopoulos didn't seem to press him on that question, which is kind of interesting. Because if I'm standing there talking with the president, and I'm getting the impression he doesn't really want to talk about UFOs, but he mentions having had a meeting, I might ask a question like that. Can you state for us, Mr. President, was that an official meeting? Were you briefed? Did this involve military? He might not have been able to comment. He might not have wanted to. You know, he might not have cared. But those are questions that remain, and with what little we have to deal with, I do think that maybe people are reading a lot more into that. But what's interesting to me also is, as I was looking at that, and I'm revisiting this long-held fascination I've had for quite a while with politicians and also U.S. presidents who have been asked about or who have commented of their own volition on the UFO subject, I was reminded of that exchange that occurred back in 2016, where during an appearance on Jimmy Kimmel Live, Hillary Clinton was asked about UFOs by the late night host. And you'll remember Hillary saying, well, we have a different name for those now. We don't call them UFOs. We call them UAP. And that's the latest nomenclature. I remember her talking about that so matter-of-factly when she appeared on Kimmel's program during the election and kind of being fascinated. We covered it on this program too. And what's interesting about that to me, of course, is that here we have a very contentious U.S. election. Jimmy Kimmel has quite a reputation for asking both past U.S. presidents and also hopeful contenders in the present their opinions on that subject. It's quite obvious that he's interested in that. And you might also say that knowing that if you ask that question, it's going to arouse a lot of interest. And so it's going to generally help with the promotion of your program. Although, again, you would think that having a former U.S. president as a guest on your program is going to get a lot of attention anyway. That said, Kimmel has quite a reputation for asking former commanders-in-chief, present commanders-in-chief, and then also presidential hopefuls about this question. So I wasn't surprised when it came up. What I did not know, however, was that what Clinton had to say about UFOs and saying that we call them UAP now, that was actually a bit of a scripted response, and it had been Jimmy Kimmel's idea for her to say that. How do I know this? Well, it's quite interesting, and it actually has to do with those controversial email leaks that occurred back in 2016. That's right. Now, if you head over to the WikiLeaks website, I actually found this email exchange, which leads off with a quick message from Sarah Latham, who had worked for Hillary Clinton, And this email had been one that had been sent to John Podesta, and hence how it became public knowledge, because it was the Podesta emails that were leaked. And she says, UFO clearance for Jimmy Kimmel, and forwards him a series of correspondences. And in the forwarded email from Latham, she says, he, talking about Jimmy Kimmel, thinks it would be awesome and funny if she, Hillary Clinton, explained that you don't use the term UFO anymore. I mean, this is all in the emails. This is fascinating. Listen to what it says. They actually give the following example of what Jimmy proposed that Mrs. Clinton say during this exchange. Jimmy, if you talk about UFOs, and this is in the email, people think you're nuts. You have to use the term UAP, unexplained aerial phenomenon. This is an issue I think the government needs to take seriously. The government has been too stingy on what information we should know, and when I'm president, the American people will find out. Now, they say John's line is the American people can handle the truth, and then they link in the email, Sarah does, to the Wikipedia page for unidentified flying object. Now, in the earlier correspondences about this, see, in that one, they're outlining what Jimmy Kimmel has proposed that Hillary Clinton say, and apparently the idea was he was going to ask her about the subject, and then as part of the joke, she was supposed to say, well, they don't call them UFOs anymore. You know, that's not the latest nomenclature, it's UAP. And when she said it, I don't think it really came across as a joke. I certainly didn't take it as being one at the time. In fact, I think a lot of people saw it as being a much more serious discussion about the subject. But in an earlier correspondence, we also had this exchange. They said, the question seems odd. Is there any further context on why Jimmy is going down the alien road? Which skit did we agree in the end? So what we seem to be able to glean from this, based on this email correspondence, which ultimately was forwarded to John Podesta, who was managing her campaign at the time, is that it was Jimmy Kimmel's idea, and actually some of the Clinton staffers, despite saying that they were aware of how interested John Podesta is in the UFO and Area 51 question, they said it seems a little odd that they want to ask about aliens and UFOs. Why are we going down this road? Was this part of the skit that we approved with the Jimmy Kimmel people? Of course, they're not going to have her on the show and not tell her or any other presidential hopeful what questions they intend to ask. Yeah, that's going to be pretty standard fare, right? But I found it very interesting that the whole idea about UAP, not UFO, was attributed to Jimmy Kimmel, according to those emails. And that after the fact, we find out because those emails were leaked by WikiLeaks. I mean, quite a convoluted story and an interesting one. But also consider the effect that it had. Because although it appears that Jimmy Kimmel had thought it would be funny, and again, let's make no bones about it, he is interested in the subject. He wouldn't ask all of these politicians about the UFO subject if he weren't. And the fact that he also asked Hillary Clinton was only in keeping with his pattern of behavior with other presidents and presidential hopefuls whom he had asked about this. So that's not unusual. But the fact that it had kind of been intended as a joke, and Hillary's delivery was a little dry. Again, if you go online and watch, you'll see what I'm talking about. As a result of that, I think it came across sounding a lot more serious in tone than Jimmy Kimmel and maybe Clinton and her staffers had intended either. And the effect of that seems to have been this. Oh, okay, well, here we have our leading contender for the next U.S. presidency, the first woman who was at that time believed probably, and all the polls were showing they believed that she was probably going to clinch the election and she was going to win. So we have a very experienced person in government, you know, a woman who will be the first woman to serve the office of president, and a woman who is also very outspoken and matter-of-fact about UFOs and using this updated language. Jimmy, we don't call them UFOs, it's UAP. To me, I think that both the UFO community and maybe more importantly, a lot of people outside the UFO community were hearing her talk about that and go, huh, what's she talking about? I mean, she seems to be treating this subject really seriously. And in fact, she's saying, well, there are these other terms that we use for this. And yeah, I think that the government needs to release what it knows. I think that the end effect wasn't a joke. It was people going, okay, she seems to take this seriously. Maybe we should too. And as is further evidenced by those emails that were leaked, we also know that Tom DeLonge and some of the people that he had been working with at that time in advance of the foundation and formation of what we now know as the To the Stars Academy, Tom DeLonge had been going and he had even met with Podesta and presumably met with Podesta and brought along with him Major General William McCaslin from Wright-Patterson Air Force, who was basically the head of the science division there at Wright-Patt. That they'd actually gone and met with Podesta, and it's spelled out for you in the emails. Tom DeLonge wanted to go and meet with Podesta, a guy who's very interested in UFOs, and talk with him about UFOs, and bring along this high-ranking member of the Air Force to talk about it too, to share in that conversation. So it's kind of fascinating that this was all percolating behind the scenes. I think what they were banking on was the fact that, yeah, Podesta was very sympathetic to the idea of UFO studies and its serious treatment. Hillary Clinton, although it might have been intended by Jimmy Kimmel as a joke when he had her on, I'm sure that was predicated upon what he already knew, which was that, yeah, she and her husband, Bill Clinton, had long held an interest in that subject. So it wasn't just a joke. It was actually built on a legitimate long-held interest going all the way back to when Bill Clinton was elected, and they were invited out to Lawrence Rockefeller's ranch, and there was what was called the Rockefeller Initiative that was launched, where basically he was encouraging, he was kind of working as a UFO lobbyist, Lawrence Rockefeller, and had encouraged Bill Clinton to try and release as much information as he could while in the office of president. And that is why when Jimmy Kimmel asked Bill Clinton if he had found anything, he said, "No, I didn't, but if I had, I would have told you about it." That's right. So again, there is a bit of history to all of this. Many probably aren't aware of that. But in the immediacy of the last election, and with all this stuff going on behind the scenes, where obviously Tom DeLonge and whatever he was putting together that we now recognize as To the Stars, they were banking on Hillary getting elected and being able to have an in Washington through guys like John Podesta. That seems to have been the objective. And hence they were meeting with him in an election year while he was managing her campaign and it a highly contentious election. And then WikiLeaks drops those emails. Talk about an interesting story, and that reveals some of the behind-the-scenes aspects of it, too. But I think that the broader cultural impact, again, leave politics and your own positions and, you know, how you feel about this candidate or that, you know, leave all that at the door. I think the broader public impact was here we have a person with a career in politics running for president and who seemingly is discussing this subject very seriously. I definitely think that that had an impact, and in advance, of course, of a little article that appeared in the New York Times in 2017, which introduced the public for the first time to what we now know is the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. And the story only gets more convoluted from there, ladies and gents, because as we've reported recently on the program, that's right, there are some questions that some have raised about the nature of this program and who was involved. Well, one former U.S. senator had something to say about that recently, and I want to talk about that aspect of all this when we return here in a moment on the Graylian Report. Broadcasting from the high mountains of Appalachia, I am Micah Hanks. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. Yeah, so a lot of us in my research circles have been following very closely this Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, of which there's already been plenty said, and anyone who has been watching the new program on History Channel called Unidentified Inside America's UFO Investigation, you're probably already aware of what this all has to do with in this program. Although there are some questions about what exactly is it or was it? Was it a program? Was it a contract? Was it both? Was it a pet project? You know, was it more like a study that went for an indefinite period as opposed to a elite team that was, you know, chaired by this individual and here are all the members? You know, what little we do actually know about it was a document that George Knapp posted online. There had been some questions about its authenticity, but I believe that that actually has been proven to be authentic. And I know that that was independently confirmed by my friend John Greenwald, who'd asked about that. But Harry Reid had actually released a document, which you'll remember me referring to this on the program and asking about the funny name for the list of individuals that had been redacted toward the end. They called it a bigoted list. But one of our many wonderful listeners, who I deem to be very in the know, Craig, reached out to me, and he had said, "Listen, you know, what that really means is essentially this is a by-name list, and there are reasons why in certain circumstances that is preferential." And he says, "What that seems to indicate to me is that if they had a bigoted list of people who were related to this project, that kind of indicates that it was probably a limited study. And by virtue of the fact that it was only $22 million that was appropriated for this study, I mean, that seems to kind of jibe with that to me. There's a little bit of money thrown at a kind of a pet project, and we have a few individuals involved. And I've even further speculated that that aspect might also have led to some of the confusion about who was in charge of the program and had responsibilities with it. And the reason I would say that is because we have recently seen in the article at The Intercept by Keith Kluwer a statement by Pentagon spokesman Chris Sherwood, who told Kluwer that, hey, you know, Lou Elizondo, the guy who's on the History Channel show, had no responsibilities with the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. And, you know, I couldn't tell you if the guy did or did not. What I do know is that Lou Elizondo says that he did. What troubles me, however, is the fact that it seems that there are some really diligent researchers who are trying to go about verifying whether he did or did not. And that is only in the furtherance of lending credibility to this entire story, in my opinion. If an individual asks hard questions as a journalist or a researcher, you know, they aren't just trying to assassinate a person's character. They are trying to get to the bottom. They're trying to ask the relevant questions and just get the facts. That's what a good journalist does. And so there are a few people asking questions about Mr. Elizondo, whether he was, again, the head of the ATIP program, and why, if he wasn't, the Pentagon would say that he had no responsibilities with the program during that time. My friend John Greenwald, I'll say, has caught a lot of flack from people in the UFO community for asking these kind of questions. I don't think he's wrong to do that, to do what a journalist tries to do if they're a good journalist. Again, I think we have to ask those questions, and I think we have to distance ourselves from the subject enough so that we don't get so passionate that we misinterpret hard questions and journalistic diligence as being attacks made by detractors. Because, ladies and gentlemen, I've had a number of attacks launched against me over the years as well, and I know very well the difference between a hard question and an ad hominem attack. But unfortunately, I think that many people make no such distinction, and even if a question is posed from a valid standpoint with legitimate concerns, and if it's asked appropriately and with no further attack or any kind of demeaning attitude or anything or inflection, it nonetheless can still be viewed as an attack because the question seems to deal with the person's veracity and whether or not they have told the full truth about whatever they've done. So with regard to the controversy surrounding Lou Elizondo, as we've reported on this program, and, you know, who knows, some people probably have seen me as being one of the detractors for even bringing up the question. But again, rather than going completely to bat for him and saying, Lou is exactly who he says he is, you know, I've merely tried to report on the fact that there have been people who have raised questions. Again, I will maintain I don't know what his actual relationship was or role may have been when he served with the DOD. I know what he has said his role was, and there was also a statement made by the Pentagon that seems to conflict with that. And my interpretation of the idea of the use of that bigoted list, which my diligent listener Craig had pointed out to me, and I think he shares this view, that might be where some of this confusion stems from. I haven't seen very many people talking about that either. And I've also heard a lot of whispers about the idea that there's going to be another statement from the Pentagon forthcoming that might clarify the matter. We're still waiting on that. That hasn't happened yet. And so for the time being, you can understand, without any further clarification, anything that has in any way rectified the two opposing views, which are what Elizondo says and then what seems to conflict with that, as said by the Pentagon spokesman Chris Sherwood. Yeah, you can understand why people are fighting about this. I would implore the UFO community to take a step back, a deep breath, and try and remove yourself from this lobbing of grenades at one another. I don't think we need to be battling each other. And part of the whole controversy is that based on, you know, the historical precedent set by things, like what my good friend Greg Bishop wrote about in his book, Project Beta, where we saw the NSA engaging in experimentation out there at Kirtland Air Force Base. Paul Benowitz intercepts some of this. He goes to the U.S. Air Force and thinks he's found evidence of alien communication. And what do? They have their OSI guys, namely Rick Doty, go out there and work to further convince him that he's right. They encourage the belief, the erroneous belief, so as to further mask what the NSA is actually up to. Yeah. And then, of course, shortly thereafter, there's the release of the MJ-12 documents, the majority of which are proven to be bogus. Yeah, there's historical precedent for intelligence agencies using people's interest and belief in the UFO subject as a sort of a smokescreen for other things that have been going on. And I think that due to the fact that that is so well known, many people see the potential for all of these guys who once worked in government getting involved in UFO research and public advocacy of, you know, research into this subject as being a little suspicious. That may not really be the case, is the thing. I'm saying there is historical precedent for why people would believe that. And so, unfortunately, I find that the UFO community is very embattled at the moment as a result of this controversy. But I would simply say this. If indeed it were some sort of a psyop, let's just say that it was something similar to like what we saw with Paul Benowitz and the misinformation that he was given. Don't you think that if indeed that was actually what was going on, there would be no better outcome than to have the UFO community split in half and hell-bent on fighting each other rather than trying to work harmoniously toward a resolution and understanding all the ins and outs of what may be one of the most significant discussions that we have had as Team Civilization in all history? Unfortunately, I'm seeing a lot of the UFO community fighting each other rather than looking at the problem. This is the whole idea of misdirection, isn't it? And so I think that whether or not there's any such thing going on, again, I have said recently on the program, I want to believe in the tradition of X-Files, right? I want to believe Lou Elizondo, and I want to believe that what he and Tom DeLonge and all these guys are doing is exactly what it's being represented as. I want to believe that. That doesn't mean that I just give myself to belief in it. I want to believe it, though, because if indeed it is what it's being presented as, this is a really good thing. It is a much-needed effort toward transparency on a subject that has been relegated to the lunatic fringe, and wrongly so, for far too long, in my opinion. So yeah, I do advocate transparency and serious discussion of this issue and science being applied to it. And so again, that seems to be what the To the Stars guys are doing. I want to believe that if that's what they're doing, this is a good thing. But when contradictions appear and no one seems to be forthcoming with any kind of a statement that clarifies irrefutably why one person says they held this position and did this, and then people at the Pentagon are saying something completely different. I mean, it is only right that we start asking questions. If we turn a blind eye, or if we start attacking each other, I just think it's the wrong approach. We have to ask these questions. We have to get to the bottom of it. We need to understand all the nuances of something so potentially important, I think. Now, that said, recently on public radio in Las Vegas, former Senator Harry Reid did an interview in which he talked about everything from potential impeachment and a lot of political issues going on in Washington right now to, yes, the UFO study group, the ATIP program. And at one point he was asked about Luis Elizondo and some of the questions that had been raised about him in the recent article at The Intercept. And I have an audio soundbite where Harry Reid discusses having met Elizondo and saying that he indeed thinks that Elizondo is a person of character and that his claims have veracity. We have that audio.
By the way, in this History Channel report, the guy who is interviewing people is Luis Elizondo. He was in charge of the Pentagon's, it was called the ATIP program, and that's an acronym for something.
Wow, just got to interject right there. This journalist was really prepared. They didn't even know what the ATIP stood for. Whatever this thing is, I'm not sure exactly, but you guys studied UFOs, right? Anyway, we continue.
I'm not sure, but it's basically the program set up with that $22 million. And there are online now, there are people saying that he never actually had this Pentagon job of looking into these UFO sightings. So can you verify that he is the guy? Have you ever met him? Can you verify that he is who he says he is?
I've talked to Lewis several times. Met him here in Las Vegas recently. So here's one thing that we have to understand with this. First of all, I believe in science. And that's what we should be dealing with. But there are some people who have wanted for many years to have kind of a kind of conspiratorial issues, kind of weirdness. And when they are challenged with real science, they don't like it. So that's the problem we have with this. And then you have people who are just coming aboard, and they want to also report what I saw flying saucer and all this stuff, some of which is true. Most of it, of course, isn't. So Elizondo is a real guy. People are out there trying to, a few people out there trying to punch holes in what he is saying and what he does. But he was part of the Defense Department, no question about it, and a man of, I think, veracity.
So there you go, former Senator Harry Reid talking about Lou Elizondo saying, yeah, he is who he says he is. He did work for the Defense Department. He was part of ATIP, and I believe he's a man of veracity. Now, I just have to apologize, by the way, to all my listeners out there who may be apoplectic at this point because they're hearing Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and Harry Reid. I get that from my listeners all the time. They're like, oh, no politics. We don't want politics on the show. Again, keep in mind, this is a result of the fact that all of the aforementioned are now discussing a subject near and dear to my heart and one that we address very frequently on this program. And so when there's news like this, we've got to address this. But also, let me point out a couple of things about the audio soundbite we just heard. And I also want to thank Mr. G, one of my fine listeners out there, another one who likes to keep a slightly low profile, but he knows who he is and sends along audio soundbites like that. I always appreciate those from all you guys. You can send them, if you have one as well, info@MicahHanks.com. If you got a news tip or something you would like to bring to my attention or hear me cover on the program. Can't get to all of them, but when I'm getting really good news tips like that, we're absolutely going to dig into them. So with regard to that audio soundbite, this whole situation is so weird. Again, we find out after one of the most contentious elections in history, courtesy of a whistleblowing agency, if you want to call them that, WikiLeaks. People have almost as mixed feelings about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks as they do all of the aforementioned politicians. But they release all of these DNC emails. Some information about UFO stuff comes up in those emails. Not government hiding UFOs, but politicians having meetings and very seriously discussing all this stuff in a contentious election year. And then the following year, the New York Times blows the lid on this whole ATIP thing. And we find out that Harry Reid had been one of the senators who had helped appropriate a small amount of funding for this, that Bob Bigelow and Bigelow Aerospace, of course, had been involved, and that Bigelow was outsourcing basically the story that we've put together. Is that he was outsourcing a lot of his UFO interest at that time with some of this funding to the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. Now, this intrepid reporter has reached out to the former MUFON international director at that time who had agreed to try and help if he could, and so I requested that we set up a time to talk, and unfortunately I haven't heard back from him. I don't get the impression he's very interested in talking about this. I think ever since he left MUFON, he's kind of wanted to just be done with all of it. But I did reach out to him, and many of the members of the so-called Invisible College I joke about on this podcast from time to time, i.e. a loosely knit group of people with interest in all this who I correspond with pretty frequently, they have been in touch with a lot of the individuals involved in all this. And again, that's all in terms of just trying to get to the bottom of it. But I mean, how much weirder could it possibly get than the fact that this program becomes public knowledge? The guy who says he was the head of that program starts working with Tom DeLonge from Blink-182, the Pentagon later tells a journalist writing for The Intercept that he had no responsibilities with the program. Meanwhile, that gentleman, Lou Elizondo, becomes the star of a History Channel program that details the efforts of that program and some of the people and the UFO incidents that were being investigated by it at that time. And then former Senator Harry Reid, when asked about all this, says, no, he is who he says he is, despite what the Pentagon says. I mean, obviously, there's some confusion on this issue. So, again, I don't want to be labeled one of those detractors here. I'm trying to get to the bottom of this like anybody else. I maintain what I said weeks ago. I want to believe that Lou Elizondo and the whole TTSA group are all doing what they say they intend to do, and that their objective is to try and move this discussion about UFOs, UAP, into the public sector. In fact, that is precisely what Chris Mellon, one of the members of TTSA and also who is featured on the program Unidentified, that's precisely what he actually said during a recent Fox News interview. We have that audio.
The pilots who are observing these craft are absolutely mystified, and that comes through clearly in their public statements.
They are frustrated. They feel as though something should be done.
They're deeply frustrated, and that is the core of our show, Unidentified. We're giving military personnel on the front lines a voice. We're helping them get out the message. what it is they're encountering and why they're so concerned about it.
And we're not the only country who's having these encounters.
Absolutely not. And in fact, as our investigation unfolds over the first six episodes this season, we're going to be presenting information from a NATO ally that's been having very similar experiences.
At this point, they cut to a quick clip, or what we'd like to call in the industry, a native advertisement for the new program on history. And then when they come back around, they go back to that line of questioning about exactly what they're trying to do. And this is where Christopher Mellon says, and he actually states that he had worked with Lou Elizondo, who had been the head of that program back when he was with the DOD. We have that audio.
What's more responsible, announcing it and saying this is our problem, this is the video, or not announcing it?
Let me mention in that regard that when Lou Elizondo, my colleague, was still in the Pentagon running the UFO investigation, I worked with him, introduced him to two individuals who are direct reports to General Mattis. We were unable to get that on the Secretary's agenda. Ultimately, Lou concluded and I concluded that the only way to make progress on this issue was from the outside, to take the information to the public and the Congress. That's what this show is about, and that's what these military pilots are helping us with.
So there is Chris Mellon's statement as he appeared on Fox News just prior to the airing of this new program on history. Again, at the end of the day, it's kind of hard to know exactly how this is all going to shake out. I guess we just need to try and find our way to a narrative that works. When there are conflicting opinions and ideas, that's going to cause a problem, of course. We just want to know the truth. But at the end of the day, I think what's most important is that we keep our eye on the long game, you might say. The bigger question, of course, is what does the UAP represent? That's what I think we all want to know. Okay, we will wrap up when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Back it is, the Graylian Report. I mentioned at the outset of the program there would be an update on another aerial mystery, but certainly not one having to do with UAP and what we've just spent a lengthy segment discussing. No, this was a recent article that appeared in The Atlantic that Adam Olson sent along to me, and this had to do with MH370. And, you know, there aren't a whole lot of huge takeaways, but the premise of the article is essentially this. They're saying, you know, with most of the official investigation having come to a conclusion now, somebody knows something. And in fact, what the author says is essentially that Malaysian officials need to own up to what they know. And to quote briefly here from the article, the author writes, if the wreckage is ever found, it will lay to rest all the theories that depend on ignoring the satellite data or the fact that the airplane flew an intricate path after its initial turn away from Beijing and then remained aloft for six more hours. No, it did not catch on fire yet stay in the air for all that time. No, it did not become a ghost flight, able to navigate and switch its systems off and then back on. No, it was not shot down after long consideration by nefarious national powers who lingered on its tail before pulling the trigger. And no, it is not somewhere in the South China Sea, nor is it sitting intact in some camouflaged hangar in Central Asia. The one thing all of these explanations have in common is that they contradict the authentic information investigators do possess. That aside, finding the wreckage and the two black boxes may accomplish little. They say the cockpit voice recorder is a self-erasing two-hour loop and is likely to contain only the sounds of the final alarms going off unless whoever was at the controls was still alive and in a mood to provide explanations for posterity. The other black box, the flight data recorder, will provide information about the functioning of the airplane throughout the entire flight, but it will not reveal any relevant system failure because no such failure can explain what occurred. At best, they say, it will answer some relatively unimportant questions, such as when exactly the airplane was depressurized and how long it remained so, or how exactly the satellite box was powered down and then powered back up. The denizens of the internet would be obsessed, but that is hardly an event to look forward to. The article concludes basically saying that the important answers probably don't lie in the ocean, but on land in Malaysia. They should be the focus moving forward. Unless they are incompetent as the Air Force and air traffic control, the Malaysian police know more than they have dared to say. The riddle may not be deep. That is the frustration here. The answers may well lie close at hand, but they are more difficult to retrieve than any black box. If Blaine Gibson wants a real adventure, he might spend a year poking around Kuala Lumpur. And I think that that's a fair point. The Malaysian police probably do know more than they have let on. And yet that may also not be enough to solve the case. But at the end of the day, people like mysteries. People are compelled to try and find answers to mysteries. I'm that way, you're that way. We wouldn't be listening to podcasts like this, and I wouldn't be producing one if that weren't the case. We love mysteries. And stories like that of MH370 or the ongoing UAP thing, strange disappearances in the national parks, and a host of other topics we discuss on this program remain fascinating to us for that reason. They are mysterious. However, as we see, I think, from time to time, that makes them, some of them at least, no less important for discussion. And that'll have to be the final word for this week's edition of the program. Thanks to all you guys out there for always doing what you do on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Studios. Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Race and Robert Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pintrill, James Waldo, Tiffany Mack, the lovely assistant Lauren, Matthew Oakley, and yours truly, I am Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. We will catch you guys next time. And as always, stay strange out there.